Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare administration and policy at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, a conversation with Jacksonville's chief health officer, Dr. Sunil Joshi. Then, famed vaccine expert Dr. Paul Offit joins us to talk about deciphering vaccine myths. But first, do you remember what year this song was number one on the Billboard charts? Answered 2000, then you're right. That's the very same year that the World Health Organization declared measles eliminated in the United States due to the success of vaccination efforts. Now, before the vaccine was available in the U.S., the CDC estimated that more than 3 million Americans were infected each year, resulting in over 48,000 hospitalizations and 400 deaths annually. The last major outbreak occurred from 1989 to 1991, in which 123 people died, the majority of whom were preschool children. Fast forward to 2023, there were 58 measles cases in the U.S. Now, in the first 11 weeks of 2024, there have been 58 reported cases of measles. Now, the resurgence of this highly contagious disease has sparked alarm nationwide. With vaccination rates fluctuating and misinformation circulating, the risk of an outbreak looms large. Jacksonville's chief health officer, Dr. Sunil Joshi, joins us now in studio, aiming to enlighten us on the importance of immunization, dispel myths surrounding measles vaccines, and outline strategies for safeguarding our city and community. Dr. Joshi, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
It's so good to have you here. It's not the purpose I thought I'd be talking to you about,
right.
But perhaps we'll get to that point of our other good stuff going on a little later or at another show. But let's get to this current issue. First of all, what is the current number of cases in Florida and also locally regarding measles?
Right. So I think that's a good question, because you did mention earlier that there's already 58 cases of measles in the United States. Last year in 2023, the entire year, we saw 58 cases. So we're definitely not on the right trajectory. Here in Florida, we had 10 cases in February, most of them in Broward County. And the official data still has it at 10. It is interesting, though, that Orlando Regional Health Center did also document 4 additional cases here recently as well. The belief is that those folks picked up the measles outside of Florida and brought it to Florida. But so we're looking at between 10 and 14 of the 58 cases have been here in Florida.
which is by percentage wise, that's huge.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at all, around 25% of all of the cases have been here in Florida.
Okay, let's get everyone to speed. Remind us all, what are the measles?
Yeah, basically measles, you know, it's a very, very contagious respiratory virus, okay? And so when it first starts off, it's like any other virus where you might just have a fever, you may have runny nose, a cough, your eyes get red and watery. But if 3 or 4 days later, this very classic rash develops, and the rash starts on the head behind the ears, and it spreads distally through the rest of your body. And you can also get some funny spots inside of your mouth called Koplik spots as well. And so that's typically when the diagnosis gets made. So it's a very, very contagious respiratory virus that can then spread to involve the rest of the body.
So I mentioned the onset. Once upon a time, two decades ago, they actually even said this is gone,
right,
in the U.S. So what factors contributed to having measles come back within the community?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, over time, we really do believe it has to do with vaccine hesitancy. But what's really interesting about what may be happening right now is that COVID, the pandemic itself, might have gotten us in a situation where we know that children are behind on their vaccines because a lot of folks weren't going to see their pediatrician or their primary care doctor during COVID. And so if you think about it, that was in 2020. We're now in 2024. These are children who should be receiving their 4 to 6 year old vaccinations right now, may not have received their 12 to 15 month vaccinations, which is when you do get vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella. And we're now seeing this increase in numbers. And so some of that might be because we are behind in vaccinations. A lot of that may have been due to the pandemic.
Got it. And when you say pandemic, just people just, they're just tired of the idea, the concept of vaccines and shots.
Yeah, tired of that concept, but also the fact that during that time when we were expecting our kids to receive their vaccines, we weren't going to the doctor's offices. And so you had to get those vaccines in a healthcare provider setting, and people missed them. And so as they missed them, the time has gone on. They've continued to miss some of these vaccines. And now, of course, some of these infectious diseases are becoming more prevalent.
How effective is the measles vaccine overall?
Yeah, great question, too. So, you know, we're talking a lot about vaccines these days. The measles vaccine is typically a 2-dose vaccine. Again, given to children between the ages of 12 months and 15 months, and again, between 4 and 6 years. And when done that way, when you receive 2 doses, it is 97% effective at decreasing the chances of someone getting the measles if they were fully vaccinated. But even if you just get 1 dose, it's 93% effective. So the combination is terrific. 1 dose is still adequate, but we really like to see people get both doses.
And is it because it's because of that high effectiveness, that's what makes it like the key to keeping this whole thing at bay?
Absolutely. So a 95, 97% effective vaccine, meaning that these folks, when they get vaccinated, only have a 3% chance of actually picking up measles, makes it very hard for that respiratory virus to spread if we have a population that is vaccinated. And so, you know, we have schools that typically have over 97% vaccination rate. If you start to see those numbers start to decrease, measles can start to spread.
One of the things that you just mentioned that is causing all of this is vaccine hesitancy. And I imagine in the measles world, there's a lot of misconceptions. In fact, our second guest is one of the people who actually helped completely eliminate a few of those misconceptions about measles. But we're going to talk to Dr. Offit later. But what are some of the common misconceptions about measles and its vaccine that you hear?
The most common myth is that measles vaccine leads to autism. And we know that that is not the case. There are studies looking at over 650,000 people, not just in the United States, but through Europe, that suggest that the measles vaccine is not only not associated with autism, doesn't increase your risk of autism, and people who are vaccinated do not have a higher chance of getting autism. So there is no connection there to that. I think that's what, more than anything, frightens people, is that you look at children with autism and you're like, if I give them the vaccine, they may get it. That is just, it's a myth that we have to do a better job of educating our patients on, that is truly not fact.
one of the things that people will cite, and sadly, not too many experts, but some, is this whole idea of herd immunity. Yeah. Let it just run through run through a population. Can you explain why it's not a good idea in the world of measles?
Right. And so, you know, we look at herd immunity as being, as the population being immune. We prefer that the population be immune by getting a vaccination as opposed to getting the natural infection. Because if we're talking about viruses that we are trying to have people vaccinated against, these are typically deadly viruses. And measles is that. 1 in 20 people who get the measles ends up in the hospital. And you can also have encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain from the measles, have long-term neurologic complications, as you would know, Joe, from the measles. And so we don't want natural immunity as much as we would want vaccinated immunity for these particular diseases. And for what does herd immunity mean? It basically means, I like to call it population immunity. So if you look at a virus is looking for a susceptible host, a susceptible human being that it can enter in and then grow. And it can do that if you're not immune to that particular virus. And so it finds the people who aren't immune, grows, replicates in there, and can then be spread to other people. The more people who are immune against a virus, the less targets that virus has to attack. So if we have a 97% vaccination rate, suddenly this virus comes around, it only has 3 out of every 100 people that it can attack. And if it attacks one of those three people, that person now has less people to spread it to. So the virus doesn't get a chance to grow through the community. As the vaccination rates start to decrease, the immune rates start to decrease, now the virus has more targets. If you have more targets, you can spread more more directly through the community. And that is the concept of herd immunity. The more people that are immune, the less likely we can get this virus to spread through the community.
You mentioned, at least in the early question about what is measles. So let's say someone is listening out there. At what point, what are those things other than the rash, which you can't miss it?
Right.
Are there any big signs or symptoms that should make someone wonder, oh my goodness, this could be measles?
Well, in particular, the rash is a big one, you know, but then on top of that, if you know you've been exposed to somebody who has the measles, then you should really be thinking about it. If you or your loved one is not vaccinated against the measles, has these symptoms, or has been exposed to somebody with measles, your index of suspicion should be raised significantly at this point. And so a lot of it depends on who you've been exposed to. Are you an international traveler? Do you work in healthcare? Have you been vaccinated? And then do you have these signs and symptoms? And if you do, you really should go see your healthcare provider to be tested. And there's a simple nasal swab or a pharyngeal swab, just like we would have done for COVID, that can do a PCR test and get tested for measles that way. If it's more than 72 hours since your symptoms started, that's where getting that blood test for IgM antibodies comes in very helpful.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about measles with Jacksonville's Chief Health Officer, Dr. Sunil Joshi. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X at JServin. Is it just kids that is the at-risk group, or are there other groups that are just as at risk as kids?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so in particular, pregnant women, we are very concerned about pregnant women picking up the measles. International travelers are much more likely to pick up the disease. Healthcare workers, of course, because of the nature of our profession. And then adults who are not immune. So there are adults who never did receive the vaccine, and would certainly be at risk of having complications from the measles as well. And of course, our severely immune compromised patients, those who may be on immunosuppressive therapies that make their immune system much less likely to mount an immune response, would be susceptible to the measles as they would be to any virus.
You talk about the vaccine hesitancy, and is this just another symptom of misinformation spread? I mean, where do you think it's coming from?
Well, yeah, vaccine hesitancy has been going on even pre-pandemic, right? We were dealing with this for quite some time. And so there's misinformation and then there's disinformation. I look at misinformation as people who have the wrong information and they may be spreading it, not knowing that they're spreading bad information. Okay, this is, it happens all the time, you know, and so that happens, and that catches on, and social media kind of spreads it, and before you know it, this misinformation is spread, and we need to do a better job of educating the public so that doesn't happen. But then there's disinformation, when you may be intentionally spreading information to make a point, whether it's a political point or you know, you're not interested in the way vaccines are made or whatever the case may be, and you start spreading that information and knowing that it may hurt people. And unfortunately, I think that that's also what's happening now in our society with quick information, social media. Things get out there on TikTok and Twitter so quickly, and it spreads very quickly as well. And so we're having a hard time actually controlling that disinformation, because once it spreads, people start taking political points and their political view kind of adjusts their thought process.
This is not a political show, but I'm going to ask a question that kind of slightly leads us there.
Okay.
As we all know, and as headlines have all reported, the Surgeon General of Florida has had very contrary advice to the folks at Broward County, and basically saying parents make their own decisions when it comes to keeping their child at home in this measles outbreak. The CDC and national figures have all come out strongly saying wrong. That is not the way this is handled. And in fact, that's dangerous. Simple question to you. Mm-hmm. Who should the public listen to?
You know, it's interesting. Through the years, I've learned that the public, individuals are going to listen to who they trust.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, you know, I would suggest that they should listen to their trusted healthcare provider on this. And I will say that the vast majority of healthcare providers in our community will base their decisions on the CDC guidelines. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been around for over 50 years with guidelines that have helped to keep our community safe, in particular for viruses that can cause lifelong disease processes in people. So the goal here is to stop these disease processes in their tracks before they start to hurt people. And the big thing here is to prevent that from happening. It's about prevention, prevention, prevention. And we should be proactive instead of reactive. And so ultimately, the CDC really does have that stance. And that's typically what the vast majority of healthcare providers in our community would follow, or the CDC guidelines. And that's what we're going to communicate out on behalf of the city of Jacksonville, is based on CDC guidelines.
Given you are the chief health officer and basically are looking at this to keep us all safe.
You're right.
What initiatives or programs is your office doing to try to implement and promote vaccines and or just keeping us all so that this does not turn into a situation
here? Right. So we have to be concerned here in Duval County because we do have cases in the other parts of the state. It is spring break. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of people traveling in and out of Jacksonville right now. And so over the next week to 10 days, we have to be on high alert of measles cases, especially as kids then go back to school. And so we have been in direct communications with our local Department of Health. The Florida Department of Health here in Duval County has a plan. They've already been talking to schools and are identifying schools that have relatively low vaccination rates for the measles. They have a plan in place for contact tracing if we should do that. They've reached out to us to see if we can set up community pods for vaccinations, in particular near the schools that may be at lower vaccination rates, so that we can get students vaccinated, but also adults who may not have been vaccinated, get the vaccine out to them, and to promote that importance as well. And so the ducks are in place in case we were to start to see cases here, so that we are not reacting in time. We are proactive, much like we are with hurricanes and other natural disasters. We have a plan in place, and we have a very, very good working relationship with our Department of Health here in Duval County, so that we can communicate these messages.
If a person is out there and they just want to protect themselves and their family, what steps should they take?
The first thing is to make sure that you or your children are vaccinating against the measles, right? 97% effectiveness rate. Do that. Make sure that's the case. If you are not and you are exposed to somebody with measles, then you need to isolate your child. And my recommendation would be to keep your child away from that area where the measles may be prevalent so that you can reduce his or her risk of getting the measles. Or if you know that your child has been exposed, to have them vaccinated within 72 hours. That can also make a huge impact there. But the number one thing that you can do if you're concerned about you or your loved ones getting the measles is make sure you're vaccinated. 97% chance you're not going to get it if you have the vaccine.
Let's say you're in that small percentage and there is an individual, for whatever reason, that actually may have a case. And you don't want to get other people sick. Simple question, what should they do? And do you go to the ER urgent care clinic or do you not go?
Number one, you do need to identify whether or not you have measles or not, right? So you start having the symptoms, you may develop the rash, please go and get tested. And if you do test positive, that child does need to be isolated at least until 4 days after the rash is developed. And so you want to keep as many people outside of your home safe as possible, especially if vaccination rates are lower, as they may be right now in the community. And so number one, get tested, confirm the diagnosis. But in the meantime, if there's a high index of suspicion, your healthcare provider will tell you to isolate during that time as well, so you're not out there spreading this. Because remember, measles, if you are not vaccinated, it will spread to 9 out of every 10 unvaccinated people. It spreads at a 90% rate to the unimmune. So there's a very high chance that if you're unvaccinated and you're exposed to somebody with measles, you will pick it up.
One other point that often gets brought up is a lot of times people now assume everything is like COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, even though you've done a beautiful job of describing measles, mm-hmm. and I just brought up COVID, but can you differentiate what are the consequences? Because people say, COVID's no big deal. This is just like that.
Yeah, no, not even close. And so remember, first of all, the measles vaccine has been around since 1963. This is a vaccine that's been around for 61 years, okay, and is incredibly effective and has been tested. So whereas people had those concerns about the COVID vaccine, that would not be the case with the measles vaccine to begin with. Number two, the reason why the vaccination came out in the first place is because of all of the health consequences people are getting from the measles, whether it's swelling of the brain, encephalitis, hospitalizations leading to pneumonia, lower respiratory tract infections. It was a devastating disease that the vaccine by itself has significantly reduced the consequences for. And so, again, very, very important for us to distinguish those two. One thing that we should know about measles, too, is it is a reportable disease. So if you are diagnosed with it, your healthcare provider really is to report that to the Department of Health. And there is a phone number here locally, 1-904-253-1850, press option 1, and you can report that. It is important so that we can help control the disease, contact trace if and when necessary, and keep that contained appropriately. I do think that's an important message that should be thrown out there.
Last question, what message do you want to make sure you leave with the public today?
I think it's important to know that, hey, keep in mind that your City of Jacksonville health team and the Department of Health here in Duval County are on top of this. We feel very comfortable that we have a plan in place should there be measles outbreaks, to work with the school, the Duval County Public Schools, work with some of our city departments to get information out there, get people vaccinated appropriately, but also to isolate folks who need to be isolated by contact tracing. We are going to do everything we can to keep the community safe, but also keep in mind that the vaccination works, 97% effectiveness. So if you or your child has not been vaccinated, please consider getting it. Go to your primary care provider, get that vaccine, and you'll keep your community safe.
Dr. Joshi, I just want to thank you so much for giving us your time today. I know how busy you are. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for giving us this opportunity. It's important for us to get the word out ahead of the game. We love to be proactive. And I look forward to that time where we can talk about all the programs we're going to put in place to keep our community safe and healthy as well.
Absolutely. The data is always open for you. We've been talking to Chief Health Officer for the City of Jacksonville, Dr. Sunil Joshi. Up next, your weekly health headline, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It? This week's health headlines bring a mix of concerning and fascinating developments. We start in California, where a study reveals a troubling trend. While lung cancer rates are dropping for most groups, they're increasing by 2% per year for non-smoking Asian American women. Surprisingly, more than half of Asian American women with lung cancer have never smoked, rising to 80% to 90% for Chinese and Indian American women. Scientists are actively researching this phenomenon with ongoing studies at the University of California, San Francisco, and New York University to understand the risks better and detect tumors earlier. Another study suggests that increased screen time for children aged 12 to 36 months is linked to decreased talking and interaction during these crucial early years of development. On another note, in a concerning cyber attack, the nation's healthcare system faces a crisis with unpaid bills piling up due to the takedown of Change Healthcare, a major medical claims processor. This has left up to 25% of physician practices in severe financial distress, echoing the revenue challenges seen at the start of the pandemic. Federal officials have responded with measures such as encouraging accelerated payments, but healthcare advocacy groups are calling for more support, especially for doctors. On a lighter and unusual note, German researchers have studied a man who received over 200 coronavirus vaccine shots without harm to his immune system, though this was an extreme case of hypervaccination. In a groundbreaking discovery, microplastics have been found in blood vessels for the first time linked to an increased risk of heart problems. The FDA's decision to delay action on the Alzheimer's drug donanemab, opting for further expert review, is notable. Additionally, the FDA approved Wegovy, a weight loss drug for reducing cardiovascular risk in adults who are overweight or obese, expanding its potential impact on public health. Lastly, a new study calls into question the extent of the maternal mortality crisis in the United States, which has long posted a disproportionately high rate of maternal deaths compared with other nations. Data classification errors have inflated U.S. maternal death rates for two decades, according to the study published recently in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Instead of the maternal death rate more than doubling since 2002, it has remained flat, researchers found. Those are your weekly health headlines. Today we have a special interview with renowned immunologist and author Dr. Paul Offit. He is an American pediatrician who is known for his work in infectious diseases, vaccines, immunology, and virology. He co-invented a groundbreaking rotavirus vaccine and holds the title of the Maurice Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. With a career spanning as a former chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, he's a prominent voice in vaccine advocacy. His expertise extends to membership in the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee and past service with the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He is a leading advocate for the scientific consensus that vaccines are not linked to autism, making him a crucial figure in public health and vaccine education. He's joining us because his latest book is Tell Me When It's Over, How to Fight Vaccine Misinformation. And he explores in this book the critical role of vaccines in combating the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the pervasive spread of misinformation surrounding them. His book offers a compelling look at the challenges of vaccine hesitancy and the impact of false information on public health and how we can navigate through the noise to make informed decisions about our health and the health of our communities. Dr. Offit is joining us, ironically, from Florida, and we welcome him to our program.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
It's so good to have you here, Dr. Offit. This is a terrific book, but I want to start off as we launch discussing it. What was the inspiration behind writing it? You probably have lots of choices of projects that you can make. Why did you want to do this book now?
Well, so I had a front row view of this. Francis Collins asked me and a few dozen other experts in the field to be part of a group called the NIH Active Group, which stood for Accelerating COVID Technological Innovations and Vaccines, which was this private-public partnership trying to get the pharmaceutical companies to test and create vaccines in a manner that we thought was most efficient. And I'm on the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. So I had a kind of a front row view, and here's what I saw, and here's the reason I wrote the book. On the one hand, you have this virus, this unusual virus, SARS-CoV-2, which raises its head in Wuhan, China in late 2019. You isolate the virus in January 2020, you sequence it. Then 11 months later, in what was the fastest vaccine ever made, we use a technology, messenger RNA, we had never used to make a vaccine before. That was remarkable. Then, within 7 months, we vaccinated roughly 70% of the United States population. Again, an amazing achievement. I think those two things, both the creation of the vaccine and the mass administration, were the greatest scientific or medical achievement in my lifetime. Then, by mid-2021, we hit a wall. 30% of the United States population simply refused to be vaccinated. 300,000 of those who refused to be vaccinated died because of that choice or because of the choice they made for their family. We had lost the trust of at least a critical percentage of the American public. And I wrote this book to try and explore why. What happened?
Let me kind of jump to that. I read the book. I loved it. But to our listeners, why do you think if you had a summit, and I want them to be able to read your book too, but why do you think we did lose that trust?
I think there were a series of communications errors. The first one was I don't know if people remember back this far, but in April of 2020, when we didn't have anything, right? We didn't have vaccines, we didn't have monoclonal antibodies, we didn't have antivirals. All we had was try and limit human-to-human contact.
Right.
The FDA really had its arm twisted by the Trump administration to authorize the use of hydroxychloroquine, which was an anti-malarial drug,
yes,
to treat COVID. Even though it became clear within a couple of months that it didn't work to do that and had a side effect, heart arrhythmias, which could be fatal. So there they authorized a drug in April. They then withdraw that authorization in June. And what that showed, at least a number of people, including me, was that the administration, that the government could basically twist the arm of the FDA to do what it wanted. And that worried people about what was going to happen with vaccines. But the good news is the FDA stood up and allowed those vaccines to be tested in a manner they had to be, which is a 2-month safety follow-up after the last dose. So that was good. But I think the second communication error, and we're still suffering this one, is in July of 2021, after the vaccine had been out for about 6 or 7 months, protection against serious disease was holding up, as you would expect. But protection against mild disease wasn't. As you would also expect, because protection against mild disease is mediated by antibodies in the circulation, and those will fade. And there was an outbreak in Provincetown, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Thousands of men get together, celebrate the July 4th holiday, 80% are vaccinated. Nonetheless, there's an outbreak. 346 men, despite being vaccinated, get COVID. And four were hospitalized, hospitalization rate of a little over 1%. That's great. That's a vaccine working well. The remaining 342 men had an asymptomatic or mild infection, which the CDC labeled in the report as a breakthrough illness. Wrong word. It suggested that the vaccine was somehow failing, when in fact it was doing exactly what it was supposed to be doing, which is protecting against hospitalization.
It's amazing to me, because what it tells me is that on one, like, you always have two arms to this. Not only do you need the science for the vaccine that's necessary or the development, which is huge, but language really, really matters.
You bet.
I get, nice and simple. Well, speaking of this, okay, we're in Florida. Our listeners are going to have a question related to the fact that, as you know, there is currently a measles outbreak in the Fort Lauderdale, Broward County area. We have the Surgeon General of Florida who's giving conflicting information to what the CDC says we should be doing for things like measles. And I bring it up in this discussion, especially when it comes to issues of misinformation. Before I get into that part of it, as someone like yourself who sits very much in the front seat for something like this, for infectious diseases and all, can you tell our listeners what they should be doing and what parents should be doing regarding measles prevention?
Right, so measles is the single most contagious of the vaccine-preventable diseases and one of the most contagious vaccine-preventable contagious diseases, period. Whenever you see one case of measles, you should be worried because it's transmitted by airspace. In other words, you don't have to have direct contact with someone who had measles. You just have to be in their airspace within 2 hours of them having been there. So when you see a case of measles, you should worry that it's the tip of a much bigger iceberg. And now we're seeing measles in 15 states now across the country, Florida being one of them. Basically, public health has two weapons against measles. One is when someone is infected with measles, they absolutely have to isolate for about 3 weeks so that no one can catch measles from them. And the second is vaccination, that when you've identified, for example, in a school that there's been a few cases, you need to make sure that everybody in that school has been vaccinated because you need a very high vaccination rate to prevent the spread. I guess at some level, we're all sort of influenced by our experiences. I lived through the 1991-1992 Philadelphia measles epidemic, where over a three-month period, we had 1,400 cases and 9 deaths. Measles can cause you to be very sick and can cause you to die, and I don't think we appreciate that.
When it comes to those out there, if they worry, well, you know, I've had measles before, something along those lines, in that type of argument, can you kind of just refresh people's memories as to what are the complications of measles? Why is it bad? Because some act as though it is it's not a problem.
Right. So before there was a measles vaccine in 1963, every year in this country, 3 to 4 million people would get measles, most children less than 15 years of age. About 50,000 people would be hospitalized, again, mostly children, and 500 would die. When children were hospitalized, when they died, it was because they had severe dehydration from the vomiting and diarrhea associated with that illness, or they had pneumonia, which was common with measles, or they had encephalitis, which is inflammation of the brain. There's nothing you can do to treat measles. You're just treating it supportively. And with the vaccine and with the second dose of vaccine in the early 1990s, we eliminated measles by the year 2000. Unfortunately, it's come back because a critical percentage of parents are choosing not to vaccinate their children. So it's not only that we don't see measles, I think we don't remember measles. I think the vaccine has caused us, has been a victim of its own success. We have lost not only how sick measles can make you, we just don't remember that disease, and thus we may be condemned to relive it.
Let me kind of get back into the issue of what's within your book, and that's looking at just this whole idea of also misinformation and how things kind of went wrong on at least on the COVID-19 vaccine. It is such a huge, fantastic gift, because I remember in those early days when we were all, you know, can I get it? Can I get it? And suddenly now when anyone brings out a new, let's get the new COVID vaccine guidelines, it's met with ho-hum or I don't have to worry about it. What's your statement in terms of the COVID vaccine as we move forward in terms of the importance of getting it?
Well, the if you define pandemic as something that changes the way we live, work, or play, this pandemic is over. I mean, it really doesn't change the way that we live our lives anymore. But the virus isn't. I mean, this virus is going to be circulating for years, if not decades, if not longer. And I think it will become one of the winter respiratory viruses that every year cause hundreds of thousands of people to be hospitalized and tens of thousands to die. The thing about COVID is you can treat it. So if you're in a high-risk group, meaning a group likely to be hospitalized, you can, if you identify yourself early as having COVID treat with an antiviral like Paxlovid, which is generally underutilized, unfortunately. But I think that probably what a sensible recommendation is that if you're in a high-risk group and you have respiratory symptoms, test yourself. And if you have COVID, treat yourself. If you're not in a high-risk group, you don't have to test yourself because you're not going to treat yourself with an antiviral. But assume that you have COVID or any of the other winter respiratory viruses, all of which can cause people to be hospitalized and die. So at least stay home while you're sick. And if you can't stay home when you're sick, please wear a mask because all these viruses can cause harm. Influenza 2 years before SARS-CoV-2 came into this country caused 800,000 hospitalizations and 60,000 deaths. Somehow we've grandfathered that all in.
We're going to take a short break for a moment and we'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Paul Offit on what's health got to do with it. And he has a fantastic new book called Tell Me When It's Over. Love this title. Dr. Offit, how did you choose that title? It's so funny. As I read it, it really caught my attention.
Right. I think because that was the question I got asked more than any other as we move forward in this pandemic. Tell me when it's over, because I think we're all pretty much worn down by COVID at this point. I think we have booster fatigue. And so when are we done with this? And I think the answer is we're certainly done with the pandemic, but we're not done with the virus. So how can we handle it sensibly at this point?
One of the big issues has to do with just social media and its impact on all of this, particularly getting vaccines. What role do you think social media has in the spread of vaccine misinformation? Do you think are they the big group to blame in this? How do you view their role?
Without question. It's overwhelming. I'll give you a specific example. In 2009, there was a swine flu pandemic swept across the world, entered this country, killed thousands of people. The head of the CDC at the time was Richard Besser, and he was great. He was out in front of the public every other day explaining, here's what this vaccine is, here's what the disease is. And he was always answering the media's questions, or said another way, he was answering the public's questions.
Right.
I saw him at a recent meeting. I told him that. I thanked him. He said, thank you. I could never do it today. Two reasons: politics and social media.
Wow. So in that regard, where do we go from here? I mean, how, like, to those listening, I mean, there's a part and I say, well, how do you manage that? How do we, as consumers of health, healthcare, if you will, how do we help ourselves amidst things that we can't seem to change, the politics and social media is just so ubiquitous? What do you suggest?
I think we just have to do our best to get good information out there, and social media is the place to get it out there. I mean, the good news about the internet is it's a source of great and awful information. So how do you find the great information? It's there. It's often associated with, with either hospitals or professional groups, advocacy groups that offer great information, but we have to be able to find it. It's so easy to put bad information out there. I mean, here, I'm in Naples, Florida right now. I remember, weeks ago, the Florida State Surgeon General, Dr. Joseph Ladapo, sent a missive to everybody who was a healthcare professional in this state that the messenger RNA or mRNA vaccines of Pfizer and Moderna were contaminated with DNA fragments that could cause you to have cancer. I mean, it was a ridiculous statement. And there's a lot of places you can go on the internet to find out just why scientifically that was so ridiculous. I ended up being on CNN with Breonna Keeler trying to explain why that made no biological sense. Remember, assuming you live on this planet, which is pretty much true for all of us, you eat animals and plants, or things made from animals and plants that contain foreign DNA that enters your circulation. So the notion that the fragmented DNA in these vaccines, which by the way is true in pretty much everything made from cells, whether it's measles vaccine, mumps vaccine, German measles vaccine, all contain these fragments, which don't hurt you at all because they can hurt you because they can never enter your nucleus, which is where your DNA resides. But, he just sort of puts it out there and it scares people because it's a genetic vaccine, right? It's messenger RNA. And it's just that people hear the word genetic, they think, oh my God, this is going to alter my genes.
I'm smiling to your response, but yep, I'm in complete agreement. Do you think, are there, I know this is not something that necessarily within the book, but are there any historical parallels to this current situation about vaccine misinformation? Is this the first time in history we've seen this, or not really?
No, there's been vaccine misinformation from the first vaccine. The smallpox vaccine was the first vaccine developed by Edward Jenner in England in the late 1700s, which was made basically by taking a cowpox virus, right, which was harmless to people, but was antigenically similar enough to human smallpox so that immunization with one could protect you against the other. Within a few years, in early 1800s, there was a series of pictures that were done where people were getting this vaccine, had fearful looks on their faces, because they were starting to develop cow-like characteristics. They were developing tails, they were developing floppy ears, they were having little sort of cow horns growing out of their body. And I think that, frankly, biologically, some of the fears people have today are about as sensible as that.
When I talk to patients and I bring up COVID, I do hear often this issue of concerns that they were just developed, COVID-19 vaccine was just developed too quickly. How do you respond to that?
Well, it certainly was quickly. It was within 11 months. But the trials, a 40,000-person trial for Pfizer or a 30,000-person trial for Moderna, are the size of any typical adult or pediatric vaccine trial. The safety follow-up, which is standard, was 2 months after the last dose, and that had to happen. It's just that what the usual sort of when you go from phase one to phase two to phase three trials, you do them sequentially, then you build the building, then, you know, and assuming your phase three trial worked, and then you mass produce it. This sort of all happened at once because what the government did was they took the risk out of it for pharmaceutical companies in Operation Warp Speed. I think the other mistake that was made in terms of language, and actually I brought this up in December of 2020 when our FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee met, don't use the term emergency use authorization because it gives the sense that it's a different product,
right,
that this is different than a product that's licensed. When you license a product, in this case a vaccine, you not only license the product, you license the building and you license the process by which it's made. That also happened with this vaccine. But yet you had people like Tucker Carlson or Robert F. Kennedy Jr. saying, no, I'm not getting this vaccine. I'm waiting for the licensed product. They were the exact same product. And I don't think we did a very good job of explaining that.
Dr. Offit, how can we ensure that accurate information about vaccines reaches everybody, all communities, especially those who are underserved?
I think it has to happen locally. So for example, in Philadelphia, which is where I live normally, we're just on vacation at the moment in Naples, Florida, but there's a woman named Ayla Stanford, who's a Black surgeon who trained at Temple. She formed something called the Black Doctors COVID Consortium right around the time SARS-CoV-2 entered this country. And then she, with her own money and with her friends, went into North Philadelphia, a predominantly Black and Brown community, and sat in people's living rooms and explained to them why they needed to get a vaccine, because many of these people didn't have their own physician. And if they said no, she went back again and again. So here these people were now talking to someone who looked like them, who they trusted, and she vaccinated 50,000 people in North Philadelphia.
Wow.
We need 1,000 Ayla Stanfords.
That what a story there. In our last moment, Dr. Offit, what message do you hope that our listeners take away from reading your book in order to just help support good information about vaccines so that we all stay healthy? What do you hope that they take away from reading it?
Well, hopefully in this sort of look back at the last almost 4 years, hopefully people will see the genesis of how bad information gets generated and the strategies that people are using to try and combat misinformation. But know that those groups, and there's basically a dozen groups called the Disinformation Dozen that was put out there by the Center for Countering Digital Hate. They're really well-funded, very well-funded, better funded than they've ever been before. Including groups like, you know, Children's Health Defense, which is RF Kennedy Jr.'s right. group. And so it's hard. It's like trying to, you know, stop Hurricane Katrina with a plastic cup, but we have to continue to fight the good fight because so much is at stake.
Dr. Offit, I just thank you for everything you do on our behalf. And also congratulations for an amazing new book and also for giving us your time out of a very busy schedule. We just so appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
We've been talking to Dr. Paul Offit. He is the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and the author of a new book, Tell Me When It's Over, How to Fight Vaccine Misinformation. Well, that's our program for today. We leave you with another top hit from 2000 when we thought measles was gone. What else but Bye 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 from NSYNC. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer. Next week's program is a special show on colorectal cancer for Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month with Channel 4's Bruce Hamilton. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.